Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at NewBalance.com.
The C1. Welcome to Hey, Great Shot. This is the Great Shot Podcast, a Cracked Rackets and Tennis Channel Podcast Network production. My name is Alex Gruskin. It is our job here at Cracked Rackets to provide all of you listeners with all of the information you need to enjoy the plethora of events coming just around the corner on the tennis calendar. Of course, the North American Hardcourt Summer, it's starting sooner than you think. We will have the Rogers Cup, the Western and Southern Open, and of course the U.S. Open all within the next 2 months. But of course, more immediate than that are the 2021 Olympic Games. Normally, these games would have been held last summer, but of course, due to the pandemic, that was made impossible. As such, we see so many of the top players in the world descend upon Tokyo for these 2021 Olympic Games. We are going to know if Novak Djokovic is able to capture that one elusive title, that Olympic gold medal in singles, as he will be competing in this event. Of course, we're going to see many of the next-gen guys, Medvedev, Zverev, Tsitsipas, Rublev, they're all in play on the women's side. We'll not only have Ashley Barty, Aryna Sabalenka, Karolina Pliskova. I think you'll have all four of your Wimbledon semifinalists. But of course, we also have Naomi Osaka competing in these games as well. It's her home country of Japan. As such, she wants to be able to perform for her home country, despite the fact that there won't be any fans in attendance to see her play. But nevertheless, it's an exciting time to be a tennis fan, because anytime you get a once-in-4-year sort of event, that is something to get excited about. And I wanted to talk about the Olympic Games, what they have meant historically to tennis, who are some of the past champions of these Olympic Games, what were they able to do following their title, and what lessons should we learn from those title runs. And of course, I could think of no better person to join me on today's podcast to talk all things Olympics and help preview this upcoming Games than New York Times contributor, No Challenges Remaining podcast host, friend of the program, Ben Rothenberg. He and I on today's podcast talk about that significance historically of these Olympic Games. We do our best to preview the field. We debate which players perhaps erred in making the decision to forego these games, to go play, whether it's clay court events right now, early hard court summer events, just opted out of heading to Tokyo. We discuss why that may not have been the right decision, why for some players it may have been the correct decision. And then, of course, I did want to ask Ben at the start about what it was like to cover an event on the ground. That's something so many of us haven't been able to do. Attend tennis events in person, of course, as a member of the media, becomes that much more important to have access to players, coaches, to be able to accurately inform everyone what's going on behind the scenes. And so, little inside baseball talk at the start. Nevertheless, it is always a pleasure to have Ben on the podcast, so I know you listeners are going to enjoy today's show. Of course, the reason we're able to do these day in, day out is because of the support we get from all of you, from our Patreon family, and of course from our friends over at Turna Tennis. You already know Turna's the best in the business, so I'll just let you know how you can get in contact with them and join the Turna team. No reason to wait any longer. You can email sales@uniquesports.com or call 800-554-3707 today to join the Turna team. You mentioned Cracked Racket sent you. They'll hook you up with discounted college pricing, hook you up with some free samples as well, treat you like family. Again, that's email sales@uniquesports.com or call 800-554-3707 today. With that said, an Olympic preview with Ben Rothenberg. Westoff, roll the conversation. Let's get to today's show.
Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at NewBalance.com.
Joining us on the podcast once again today, a returning champion here on our Cracked Racket shows. You know his work best as the winner of the New York Times Daily Crossword Puzzle. You may also know him as a victor in your local trivia contest. Oh, yeah, he covers tennis as well. It is our friend from the New York Times, from No Challenges Remaining, from Tennis Majors, from Racket Magazine, from just about everywhere, dare I say my sensei, from the University of Michigan, most importantly, it's Ben Rothenberg. Ben, hey, great shot. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, my friend?
I'm good. Go Blue. That was quite an introduction. I actually haven't done the crossword in a few months. It's been taking some time off, resetting, letting the sort of chamber refill a bit on the app. So I have a bunch to do whenever I get in the mood again. I'll be able to blitz through some old, fresh-to-me content. Yeah, but I know the skills are still there. I'm sort of like, who is anyone doing that right now? No, I feel like everybody who's taking time off now, like, skills are questionable.
Yeah, it's
honestly,
it's because
I don't think anybody's
lockdowns are opening. People have things to do again. It's like, should I start my crossword puzzle with my day with a 15-minute crossword puzzle, or should I respond to the 45 work emails I have? Probably the latter.
You know, it's not taking me 15 minutes most days. I am speedier than that, Gruskin. Come on now. Come on.
Maybe you've just changed your coffee habits so, like, those opening 6 minutes in the day that were always there are no longer there, if you catch my drift.
Sure.
Yeah. We'll go with that. But of course, it is always a pleasure to have you now. I say you're my sensei. In reality, you just happen to be born a few years before me. We're peers more than anything else. No, but the question I have to ask you, because I know you've played some tennis in your day, I've officially reached the point where after playing a 2 out of 3 set match, everything hurts the next day. Like, it's all downhill. Like, I'm 25. I'm not proud that it's happening at this age. I like to think it's because I pushed myself, like I'm still a prime 16, 17-year-old. But there's a lot of pain. Is that going to change anytime soon?
No, it's only getting worse. I mean, it's not linear necessarily, and it's not going to be how fast it gets worse is really up to you. And I think you're, you know, pretty physically active guy. I think you'll be able to hold it off relatively. But you're also going to find yourself not wanting to push as hard as you did before because the consequences will be real. So, like, when I play tennis now, I'm not, and obviously my tennis play was never as good as yours, I'm not throwing myself around the court or, like, even trying to hit, like, serves, like, with anything on them at all. Like, I'm just kind of dinking the ball around and junking, and which I kind of always did. And I occasionally will try to rip some forehands still, of course, but the sort of in between that, it's like it's very, very controlled, minimal effort. And I don't know the last time I played a third set of anything. I mean, usually I play with Andrew Eccles, you may know from Twitter, who's a 10th person. Usually I just beat him in straights. So the third sets are not necessary.
So you bring up a point that was really what I wanted to get to, and I'm, as always, you lead me to the segue. When does it become appropriate to request only ground stroke games? To be like, look, do we really need to serve? Aren't we just here to sweat?
Any time. Okay. I mean, I think that was that ever inappropriate for you? Well, are you playing people who like request serving? I think whenever you take serving off the table, I feel like people, almost everybody's happy. I mean, you're, you know, strapping young 6 foot whatever lad who I'm sure loves throwing down bombs and stuff. But like for me, that was never my vibe.
So
people were never thinking that was going to be on the table for me.
It's a good counterpoint. When it's someone I know, there's no formalities. We can get right to the ground stroke games. We don't need to play around. If it's someone you don't know, it's a first-time hit. And I actually do think these are things listeners wonder to themselves. When you're setting up in a club, what are the sorts of things you should be doing when you're hitting for fun? Always warm up 2 out of 3 ground stroke games. If you're in shape to 21,
Ground strokes, yeah. So, interesting. I don't do a lot of ground stroke stuff where you're keeping score.
Come on.
I respect that. I definitely respect that. But the last time I played tennis was with another, I'm going to keep name dropping, with Louisa Thomas, another tennis writer. Sure. And she's legit, by the way. Yeah. She can rip the ball. I was impressed because she's not a very, you know, she's fairly slender person, but she was just like, it was nice balls from her. Anyway, I looked ridiculous out there probably with her. Anyway, she We didn't do any scorekeeping. We just sort of rallied for like an hour, mm-hmm. roughly, and it was fine. Mm-hmm. But I do sort of love, you know, I sort of pitched the idea of doing a tiebreak or something. I do like, I'm a competitive person. I like mm-hmm. competing out there, so.
No I wouldn't say former no to that. Players, so no McEnroe, no Honchakovas, no Petkoviches, no former players who have dabbled in media. Former college players, so I suppose Nina Pantic counts, she probably wins. But of tennis media, the tennis intelligentsia, as I like to refer to them, if the U.S. Open's like, we're doing a draw, media members only, winner gets free meal passes for the second week, who's winning that title?
Depends on who's there.
Everyone's there.
There's a Belgian... Well, I also haven't seen people play. We've done, like, all-time best, like... Kurt Streeter, who's a New York Times columnist, he was a tour-ranked player. He was ranked in the, I want to say, the 800s or so, and he played college. He played there. Philip DeWolf, who is a Belgian reporter, he made a French Open semifinal as a qualifier, one of the shock semifinalists. So never seen him play, but I'm pretty sure he can probably still ball. The Brits play a lot, so they're good. The people I play with most, Ricky Diamond and David Avakian, very different players. Ricky's very athletic, and David's just like beautiful ball striker, beautiful one hander. He like very very clearly someone who like studied the Federer game and tried to emulate that with actual like decent success at kind of looking stroke wise like Federer, if not the movement or anything. But there's some good players. It's, you know, most people, at least in my sort of job, who are daily writers, you know, when you're at a tournament, like we very rarely have time to play during tournaments. So I actually don't spend a lot of time playing tennis. There are certain people who do, that's important to them to make time during their tournament times, so, like get up early and go play tennis. I'm not a morning person so much, so it's not something that I often do. I do it occasionally at the U.S. Open. Carl Bialik, who lives in New York, has the courts at his apartment building, which are nice. So I've done that a few times. Mm-hmm. But there are some good players.
All I'm saying, 2 hours of up and down the river each morning determines the order of questions for every press conference. I think that's a meritocracy.
What is up and down the river? I don't even know what that means.
That's tennis players right now listening to this podcast are shedding a tear. That's a go-to drill. Like when you're in a clinic and it's like, let's figure who the best are, who the worst are, play up and down the river. It's like half court down the line up to 11, or half court cross court, play everyone on your court, best records move up, worst records move down, etc.
Okay.
It's a good
sounds
drill
nice.
Or at least
sounds
yeah
nice.
It is nice. And so anyways, that would be how we determine the press order. But speaking of that press order, enough on the opening tangent, let's talk Ben Rothenberg. On the grounds at Wimbledon, you had the opportunity to go cover the event in person. First time on the grounds in a healthy amount of time. What was your experience like? Again, any takeaways beyond the normal experience? Were there perhaps a warm reception? Just the fact no one's seen anyone in a while. And, you know, I feel like just in general, people are happy to see one another. What were your takeaways from the experience?
Yeah, it's my first tournament since Australian Open 2020. That I was at, so just about 18 months being away, and sort of a weird one to come back to. I mean, like, Wimbledon is obviously such a big event. Like, it's not usually where I start my Europe trip. I usually start my Europe trip in Rome, honestly, and then go spend the 9 weeks in Europe, you know, doing Rome, French Open, week off usually, then like Halle or Queens, and then Roehampton qualies, and then Wimbledon. So going just to Wimbledon was a different feel already. Like, starting a trip at Wimbledon was something I hadn't done before. But I was really happy to be there. I got to say, like, I had pretty low expectations for it, honestly. Like, I was like, oh, wow, there's going to be certain restrictions. It's going to suck. Like, we're not going to be able to do anything. It's going to just be, like, being at home, but over there, and it's going to be miserable. But actually, it was really, really nice just being around people who also cared about the event that was going on. That was so different. Like, I mean, you know, you live in a bungalow full of tennis people at this point. Like, you get to be around people who also care about it, members of the tribe in that way, who speak who can speak the language of tennis and who can, you know, who can get excited or care or get on the sort of pulse of an event. And that's something I didn't have at all when I was at home. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm at home with, you know, a dog who doesn't care that it's a third set tiebreak coming up, you know, who doesn't care about any of that. Like, and who whoever else is around here too, like, doesn't care. I have group chats and stuff, but it's not the same as being actually in a room of people who are also sort of you know, living and breathing the event and getting synced up with the heartbeat of the event. So that was the best part about it, just being around other people and feeling, and then also just feeling like I was sort of a functioning member of society again, you know, being in a place where I had to, you know, get dressed for work every day and shower every day and things like that, that were definitely slacking at times during the last previous 18 months, you know, just like being back. It honestly felt more like, I said this a few times, it felt more like time travel than like regular travel. Like it was going back to my old life, and that was pretty cool. There were obviously certain parts about it that were restricted, notably no access to player areas or where any of the coaches would be or anything like that, which I do think meaningfully makes the work tougher and makes the work output worse. And especially having no like in-person press conferences too, looking forward to whenever the Zooms can end or at least be, you know, at least have some in-person access, because there's a degree of humanity and spontaneity that's completely lost in the coverage when all you ever get with the players or the subjects is pre-designated Zoom times where you ask a question and you're immediately muted as soon as it finishes. It's very, very dehumanizing. And so I feel like the sort of work output that I was doing, and also I was rusty, but the work output I was doing probably wasn't by any means like the best of my career, or probably anybody. I don't think anybody's doing their best work right now, honestly, in this moment of tennis coverage. But speaking for the group, but right. But yeah,
this guy.
Well, you.
This guy's doing his best work.
This is your best.
This pod, probably not. Those opening 5 minutes, okay. I take back 3 of them. But no, yeah, you know, outside of that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think I look forward to you doing even better than that. no, but there. But you know,
my progression is linear. But go on.
It was really nice being back. I'm looking forward to being at more tournaments. I got to say, after getting a taste of doing it in person again, it's going to be even tougher to get back to doing it remote if I had to do especially another slam remote. It might not be a totally linear progress where like everything's back to normal, especially with like Australia. God knows what that's going to be like. US Open, I believe I'm going to be there in person. Cincinnati, I think I'll be at in person. Washington, definitely I'll be at in person. Although I don't know what the sort of setup for media is at those tournaments. It's still a little bit unclear at Washington, Cincinnati, last I heard. And it's pretty close when those tournaments are starting to. Not too far in the distance. So it's like 2 weeks away and 4 weeks away for those two events. So, you know, but yeah, it was really nice feeling like a functional person and being around a tennis sort of vibe was cool, and being at the matches was cool, obviously, and in the stadiums it did feel like the old days with the no masks and the full stadiums by the end. It was cool.
Mm-hmm. And to rapid fire through, because Wimbledon's in the rearview mirror, but it was good to see that your fingers still worked. Bunch of stories for you, obviously, with our friends over at the New York Times. Again, you didn't have access to the players, the coaches, like you normally would. Curious though, because it's been a year since you've been on the ground, do you feel younger at all? We talk about the generational shift happening on the in the game and in the results week in, week out. There are some new faces, right? There are a bunch of new second-week performers, obviously, here at Wimbledon in particular. We haven't seen runs like this from a Berrettini. We hadn't seen people like – it's blanking out now. All of these round of 16 matches are a blur. But the point is there's Hubi Hurkacz, obviously, Denis Shapovalov making their first semifinals. And just on the women's side as well, Sabalenka first semifinal and – just it feels like week in, week out, pick a name out of a hat. It feel that way on the grounds to you?
No, I mean, honestly, I've had some continuity in terms of, because with the players, it was just Zoom. So sure. I've been in Zooms with all those people before. And, like, the names weren't that crazy. I mean, like, Berrettini, I had spoken to, the first time I spoke to Berrettini was after, what year would it have been? It was after he beat Sock in the first round of Wimbledon during Sock's real collapse year. Mm-hmm. I guess it was 2018. So I've known Berrettini. I've spoken to Berrettini for a while. Like I did a 1-on-1 with him, which was a highlight. I did two like good 1-on-1s for the Times during Wimbledon with him, and one with him and one with Pliskova. And so Berrettini, I feel pretty familiar with. I know about him. And you know, there are some players certainly who I haven't spent a ton of time with who are moving up the rankings. Like I've barely spent any time talking to or being in the same room with like Casper Ruud, who's suddenly like a top 15
player. And
that's
the sort of player I'm referring to. It's not as much like the top names and the week in, week out interactions in the press conference. It's more just, it's a younger crowd. It's the Davidovich Fokinas have replaced the Feliciano Lopezes, if that makes sense. And as you mentioned, the Casper Ruuds are in, and like the, I'm trying to think who's a good number 30 player from like the 2012 era who's just always kind of hanging around. The point is that sort of player, El Magro was right.
Like a Verdasco.
Sure, exactly. They're gone now. Yeah. And it's a lot of young, like it's the Clara Burels of the world. And,
it was interesting because there were certainly players, you know, when I started doing Zooms for the first time, in Palermo 2020 was the first Zoom was the first tournament back from the hiatus. And I remember the first time I did one with a player I'd never spoken to before. It was different. It was because, you know, you talk to Irani or Kirstay or whoever else was playing that first day. It's like, oh, we know each other. Like, this is not that weird. Like, we have a bit of a rapport here. And I remember talking to Fiona Farrow, who I had never spoken to before. And I think she went on to win that tournament. And I was sort of like, oh, this is be different. Like, it does feel meaningfully more awkward to meet somebody for the first time on Zoom. But then, you know, now we're sort of over that. And now you lose a lot of the familiarity. Obviously, you know, lots of players relax and they see people they know. And they're still that still happens on Zoom. But last one, yeah, I'm trying to look at, like, Wimbledon I don't think was the most crazy tournament that way. Mm-hmm. Like, the new names was, like, people had a lot of runway. It was, like, Felix was a new name there. Felix and Chapo and Berrettini. That's not that random. You know, if it was, like, and even honestly, like, for the women this year, like, obviously the most random quote-unquote thing happening would be Krejcikova winning a slam, right? But Krejcikova, I had happened to know from having written about her a bunch and her story with Yana Novotna when she was a doubles player and stuff like that, and even Pavlyuchenkova. Like, Tamara Shadanshek did not know at all. Never spoken to before.
Another only 2021
French Open. Yeah, I had not spoken to her. Some people had. Some people had spoken to her. I know Reem Abilel wrote a story about Shadanshek when she was top seed in Wimbledon qualies a couple years ago. But, yeah, so there obviously are people who you don't get to know as well, but you make the most of it. And just look forward to when it's more organic. It's like so much of the sort of coverage you do and is from just picking up the vibe of a place. That's the value of being there and being, you know, behind the curtain. Oftentimes, a lot in the player areas, get a sense of how people are feeling, what the sort of rumors are, what the sort of who people are like, wow, you know, you got to watch out for... I don't know who example would be, like,
Chapo,
like, well, I was, Dom Stricker, sure, but I was thinking, like, Chapo, like, someone could say, like, before the tournament, like, oh, Chapo looks really good, like, you know, like, obviously missed the French, but, like, watch out for Chapo. That's the kind of buzz you would hear if you were just walking around, that people aren't going to randomly, like, some, like, random coach isn't going to text you, like, hey, I saw Chapo today, he looks good. That's the kind of thing you say, like, that's, like, small talk, you know, and you're not having the small talk remotely. So much. Everything has to be a little bit less organic, and you do lose something from that.
Mm-hmm. No, it's part of the process of returning to normalcy, and certainly, again, there are so many different pieces. Again, rapid fire here through Wimbledon takes. Ashley Barty, definitive number one in the women's game, yes or no?
Of course. I mean, like, who else would it be? Yes.
Is Ashley Barty best comparison for her career to date? Venus Williams, that's a take I've been brewing, yes or no?
Ooh. No.
No?
Why does that make any sense?
So
no.
Both of them win take. About 85% of their matches in their prime. Venus won 4 titles in 5 seasons. She was never ranked number one because there were more dominant power players such as Serena.
Venus was ranked number one.
No,
Venus
sorry, never one. Never she ended got... a year number one is what I'm trying to say. Is okay. What I meant to say, okay. Because there were other more perhaps dominant players like a Serena or like a Justine Henin, like a Kim Clijsters, who when they played their best seemed a little bit better than Venus's. That when I talk to people about Barty, they don't seem as convinced, like, that her ceiling is as high as some of these other players right now in the game, that, you know, again, compared to an Osaka or an Andreescu, a Sabalenka, even in her power tennis, that their best is better than Barty's best. Where are you right now on that topic?
I mean, Venus won 7 slams in a really tough era.
True.
And so I don't think that's not an easy person to compare anybody to, honestly. Venus remains the second most winning slam player of active players, behind her sister only. And nobody else has come. I guess Sharapova got 5, but she's no longer active. So, like, there's nobody that close. No, I mean, like, Barty's is an interesting one. I mean, maybe she's almost shaping up more, like, if she was doing things that, like, I don't know, Maresma was doing it, if Maresma had success earlier, like getting, you know, the one slam that was kind of fluky, honestly, like Australia 2006 for Maresma, and then backing it up with a great Wimbledon run, that feels very Maresma vibes to me. But obviously Maresma did that kind of at the end, and it was like, wow, she finally did it, kind of tale for her after having, you know, first made her first slam final in 99. So different timeline, but yeah, I'm not sure there's an easy parallel, but I definitely reject the Venus Williams comparison.
All right.
Heartily.
No,
yeah.
I like a good rejection. Who writes the Ashley Barty needs to win Australian Open piece? Who's writing that piece? Because it's coming heading into this 20. That's the missing thing. It's like all the pressure is on her. That's the storyline of the 2020s. It's coming.
I guess, yeah. I mean, like, she had a rough loss there this year. That was not a good loss for her against Mukova.
Yeah.
But I think people like Barty so much that she's not going to get that. And she's very good. at kind of controlling her narrative, honestly, mm-hmm. and you can do that. And I think she's very effective at that. And so I think that she's going to get pretty... So, I mean, obviously, if she goes, like, five more years being number one and never wins Australia, then obviously that sort of... Those whispers will grow louder about why she can't do it at home. But her results there have been solid enough. I mean, semifinal in 2020 as her first time there at number one, and then quarters this year after having not played in a long time. I don't think her results have been really worrisome there yet. But, yeah, that will be something people look for sure. Yeah, and I think she's absolutely someone who's a plausible career slam candidate, because the real long shot would have been France, from what we thought about her as a player, and she got that one first. So definitely think if she stays healthy and everything that she's got more Wimbledons in her future.
Yeah, absolutely, it will be something.
Or more Wimbledon contending, at least. Yeah.
No, again, I feel like five's an interesting number for her. If she gets to around there in terms of Grand Slam singles titles, that feels about right for Ashley Barty. That'll be a number for her to chase. But, of course, being on the ground's one thing. I'm sure you were talking with other journalists about, talking with the players and coaches you did have access to, is the Olympic Games. And, of course, that is the big upcoming event here in the summer. And, you know, the withdrawals in the event, in particular in the men's field, have felt particularly staggering of late. You know, did we start with the exhibition talk? Because the running joke is that maybe it's going to be me and Ben in the gold medal final. And honestly, I think that's a match people will enjoy watching. Because
that'd be nice.
Well, I think people would like to watch you get destroyed. And there's nothing I'd be happy more than...
I'd like to see me win five rounds to get there. What would that look like? That's really the question if I'm in a gold medal match.
You knock off Matt Racket, 13-12 in a fifth set breaker, that he's upset that that's the format you guys are playing. But you look at the field, the players who have withdrawn will start on the women's side. Six of the top 25 players will not compete. This comes from our friend Chris Otto over at Tennis Major. Simona Halep out of the event. Bianca Andreescu out of the event. Sonia Kenin out of the event. Vika Azarenka out of the event. Serena Williams out of the event. You also have no Angelique Kerber, and unfortunately no Coco Gauff, as she tests positive for COVID in the past week. You also aren't going to have any Madison Keys, no Daria Kasatkina. You know, you can go down the list, Martic, Kirstea, Konta, players who have been in the mix as well, but no Jill Teichman, I suppose. That's your last player who have pulled out. You look on the men's side, a little bit more, 11 of the top 25. No Nadal, no Thiem, no Berrettini, Federer out of this event, no Denis Shapovalov, Bautista Agut, Casper Ruud, Demonauer, Kristin Garin, David Goffin, Grigor Dimitrov, Milos Raonic, Yannick Van Rothenberg, Sinner, all out of the event. Your top 25 players. There's also going to be no Dan Evans, no Cam Norrie, no Riley Opelka, no John Isner, no Taylor Fritz. They will all opt. No Sebastian Korda either. A bunch of them opting to play the City Open, stay here, play a couple of the North American hard court events. Let's just start there. You were on the grounds during Wimbledon. I'm sure the talks continue to unfold because, quite frankly, Japan is in a different place in terms of their fight against COVID-19 than we are here in the United States, than they were there in the United Kingdom and in England. And it sounds as though England is doing spectacular against COVID right now. But given all the restrictions, I mean, what was the talk? What were the factors that go into seeing all of these players pull out?
Look, I mean, you're right what you said about every – it's one of the remarkable things about COVID is that every country, you know, has had its own journey, and there's not really necessarily a huge pattern they follow either. Like, the U.S. and Canada have had pretty different journeys. You know, the U.S. and Australia, a country we probably compare ourselves to a lot, have a lot in common with Australia. They have a completely different journey than we have had, and the U.K. has been different too. Some similarities maybe with us in the UK. It's probably not the most different in terms of COVID journeys, but Japan definitely been very different and surprisingly slow. I think a lot of people think on the vaccination. I think only something like, last I heard, something like 9% people vaccinated or double vaccinated. I'm not sure what the number was, but it was really low for a country that we usually think of as being on top of things. So that's in the background, obviously, but I honestly don't think that like the Japan COVID situation is really a factor in this Olympic exodus. I haven't heard anybody mention that. It's like, I'm worried about the COVID situation in Japan. No one said that. So it's been really disappointing. It was really disappointing to see the sort of the names pile up, and especially people, obviously there are some in there. You just list a bunch of names and some different reasons, like Coco Gauff tested positive recently. She wanted to go. Simona Halep has this bad calf injury that she was forced out of Wimbledon title defense and, and the Olympics. So she's another one who didn't really have a choice about it. Berrettini similarly had a thigh injury he suffered during the Wimbledon semifinals. Good he was able to play through it because that looked bad during the semifinal.
Federer, same deal.
Federer seems like the same deal at this point. He said he had a knee setback during his grass match, which would explain the third set against Hubie Hurkacz, which was pretty dire from him. That was a weird one to be in the stadium for, that third set of that Federer match. But there's been more and more that I can remember, like, elective people opting out, especially Americans, I gotta say. And, like, it's been disappointing, I think, fair to say. I mean, like, obviously, you know, like, everyone can do what they want, whatever, I guess. And the good news is if you pull out in time, like, some other grateful person is getting your spot. And people who didn't expect to make the Olympics from a lot of different countries are now making the Olympics and are really excited about it. I saw a post from, like, Sumit Nagal, who made the Olympics, who I don't think was making it under any sort of normal circumstances, who made it in, and he was delighted by that. But, yeah, like, there are just these players who I look at who are pulling out, and I just don't get it. Like, I just think it's such a miscalculation. I think the risk reward for playing the Olympics is so good. If you're somebody like a Jannik Sinner or a Sebastian Korda, you know, who's had the results to where in this kind of field you can absolutely be, you know, an outside medal threat. Like, I mean, like, this field is not that different from the Miami field, really, in terms of depth and difficulty. And those guys, I mean, Sinner made the final of Miami, and Korda made quarters and has only played better since then. Like, they could absolutely be in the mix to do really well at this tournament. And then you're an Olympic medalist, and that's something you have with you for the rest of your life. And it's a huge boost to your career and everything. And just, like, I don't know, like, no one's going to care in 2 years, much less, you know, 30 years, if you won Atlanta, you know, or Los Cabos. Honestly, no one's going to care. That doesn't really have any cachet. Like, I respect those events. Those are solid events on the tour.
No, it'll be a data point in Taylor Fritz was a 4-time ATP title winner. Like, that's what it is. It's not, hey, he was
no,
the
but
19th.
Like, yeah, but,
not like they say,
no. Yeah, but no one's going to care, honestly, like, if people do that. But they will. Everyone knows the Olympics. It's honestly, yeah. Even just saying you made the team. You know, both of those guys, one would assume, will have more chances to make the team, and that's what they're thinking, but you never know. Honestly, even someone like Kennan, who I know is going through a lot right now, but, like, she's never made the Olympic team before. She's trending down currently. Like, wouldn't you want to take advantage of this chance where you have an Olympic golden ticket to go and get yourself an Olympic team and, like, and do the thing once? That would be my thinking. Just, like, just from a sort of bucket list perspective, from a no regrets perspective, I've been around a lot of players in various Olympic cycles, dating back to, one of the first tournaments I ever covered, back for the website talkabouttennis.com, was the 2008 Legg Mason Classic in Washington. And that before the City Open, and that was before the City Open existed, and that was a tournament where Andy Roddick skipped Beijing to play Washington that year, and you could definitely sort of sense him regretting it as the week went on, and as James Blake went on a great run there, and just, like, everyone was all talking about the Olympics, and there was a lot of Olympics buzz, and he wound up losing in the quarters of Washington that year to Troitsky, who no one had heard of at all at that point, and you know. I just don't think it's something you'll ever regret going to play the Olympics. I just don't. Even if you bomb out of the U.S. Open, like, who cares? You'll get more U.S. Opens. And honestly, it wouldn't be because of that, almost certainly. We saw that in 2016. The two people who won the U.S. Open, I know I'm rambling here, sorry. Feel free to direct me wherever you want after this. But two people who won the U.S. Open in 2016 were Kerber, who made it all the way to the gold medal match in Rio and lost to Puig. Had, like, a long Olympic slog, and then Wawrinka, who skipped the Olympics and went just to play U.S. hard courts, whatever, and then he ramped up and won the U.S. Open that year. And so either route works. If there's no, like, proven strategy, I'm not buying that, you know, you're going to somehow derail your by going to play the Olympics and having a magical experience with your country. It's like, you see the videos there, like, I'm sure there's lots of FOMO happening from folks who pulled out, and yeah, I know there's a lot of money, I'm sure, being dangled at these guys, you know, in Los Cabos and Atlanta and stuff, but it's not worth it. And then there's other players, you know, look at, like, and I sort of didn't mention this category, but, like, Rafa, you know, Rafa pulling out of the Olympics in Wimbledon, but then signing up for Washington, which is just 1 week after the Olympics, like, immediately after the event ends. Like, that's close enough to where, like, that was a choice, you know, like, he could have played the Olympics by all appearances. I'm looking forward to asking him about this when he gets to Washington, if he does play Washington. But that's like, that was interesting too, to like say this is a calculation, like I'm gunning for New York. I think I can win this, that slam. I've won it a lot before in the last decade. LFG, USO.
All right. So where do I direct from LFG USO? That's a tough segue from there. But no, I think a lot of what you said speaks to what have the Olympics meant historically. And that's where I do want to go from here because, you know, it depends on your perspective. There's so much in sports and being a sport fan, and it applies just regardless of if this is what the title is called. There's a ring culture now, right? How many championships have you won? In tennis, it's how many slams do you have? If you don't have a slam, are you actually relevant? And, you know, are the Olympics held on the pedigree of the Grand Slams? Have they been historically? If you came of age as a tennis fan in the 2010s, you may be more inclined to put some value in the Olympic Games. Why is that? Because you look at who's won the two Olympic Games, the gold medal in singles in the 2010s, it's Andy Murray. And his winning of that 2012 gold medal can very much be considered the catapult that helped him get over the hump, win the U.S. Open in 2012, capture that first Grand Slam title. Of course, that 2012 Wimbledon gold medal came on the backs of one of the most emotional losses you're going to see in the 2012. Excuse me, Wimbledon men's singles final. And then, of course, 2016 comes around, and you have right off the bat Novak Djokovic playing close to his best tennis. And let's remember, 2016, Novak Djokovic had won not the calendar Grand Slam, but was the holder of all four major titles after the 2016 Australian Open, and was about as close to his prime as you are going to find him, and was maybe one of five times in his career he lost while playing his best tennis against a resurgent Juan Martín Del Potro. Djokovic leaves the courts in tears. And you felt the emotion for Del Potro, who was crying after his victory, who goes on, plays this incredible match against Rafael Nadal in the semifinals, wins that one as well. First three sets, honestly, all four sets of the Murray gold medal match, and I watched it like 2 weeks ago because that's just what I do. It's an incredible level, and like it was such a captivating Olympic Games. And so right there on the men's side, you're locked in. Now, of course, on the women's side, 2016, Monica Puig, historic run for her home country. And you look over the years, the success that's been had, whether it was the 2012 final, Serena versus Sharapova. That was one of those inflection point you remember where you were matches when it happened. And, you know, you can go all the way back because the Olympics, it really started in 1988 once again, but go to 96, Agassi winning the gold medal. Was that the launch point for the second half of his career?
It's
you
big.
Could argue yes. Yeah, and like 92, Capriati, and 2000, Venus Williams, 04, Justine Henin. You look at so many of these players, what the Olympic gold medal served as, and it was a launch point for them entering the primes. It just doesn't, I guess, so to ask you, because you have covered some of these Olympic Games before, has that been the trip? It does feel like the Olympic Games can often serve as a launch point.
I mean, it certainly can, but like it's a destination. It's not just like if that's all you do, like if that's, I mean, odds are at this point that's gonna be the highlight of Monica Puig's career, right? That's amazing for her that she got to be the first gold medalist in Puerto Rican history and is a national hero forever for Puerto Rico and the people there. Like, that's huge. She has that for the rest of her life, and I just know from being at tournaments where Andrew Krasny is the announcer, and he's, you know, MC for a lot of big American tournaments, Indian Wells, Cincinnati. And notably, I remember, especially in Cincinnati a lot of years, because it comes right after the Olympics, when he's doing his intros of the players and reading their accomplishments, the thing that he always saves for last, because he gets the biggest reaction, is whatever they did at the Olympics. You know, honestly, even if it's just like John Isner, let's say, for example, or not even John Isner, John Isner's a good example. Like, if he says, like, Wimbledon semifinalist and member of the U.S. Olympic team, U.S. Olympic team gets a bigger
Stevie
reaction.
Johnson, NCAA champion, but Olympic bronze medalist in 2016 in mixed doubles. Gold medal. Bronze medalist was Johnson in men's doubles.
Yeah.
Excuse me. Yeah.
Yeah, no, like Jack Sock. Like his biggest things have been his medals. I was trying to pick Isner because Isner's actually someone who didn't do amazing at the Olympics, but he did play. He did get there. Like, even still, people will get that. Like, we're people, you know, you and me. In this world, we're so deep into it. Well, Marty Fish, obviously, but I'm trying to use a more extreme example. Like, John Isner, top 10 player, won Miami, you know, Grand Slam semifinalist, is wins over everybody probably at least once somewhere. But what people who are not fluent in this tennis language we're speaking can recognize is, oh, wow, you were on the Olympic team. Like,
well,
that gets the
I
biggest
say
reaction.
Fish is, I know
well, he got a silver medal.
But that's what I'm saying is, like, that was – and he became a part of the tennis ecosystem. Like, he had recognition as an athlete in America, not just, I think, as a tennis player.
Yeah, Marty's a kind of weird example because it didn't really lead to anything directly. And actually for him, like, it was really heartbreaking, that Olympics experience. Yeah. He is like – he left with a very sour taste in his mouth from losing that match to Masoud from, I think, 2 sets to 1 up. Okay. Like, yeah. I think that was actually, like, kind of a rougher example of an Olympic hopefully he's at peace with it now. But that was – I mean, silver. There's studies that show that silver medalists are, like, less happy than bronze medalists. And I think Marty
Fish
is –
the best part of the photo op is that, like, there's this devastated silver medalist, and then the guy with the bronze or the woman with the bronze is just, like, electric and just, you know, again.
So Marty is part of that phenomenon. But, yeah, you know,
how about,
like
– If Andy Murray hadn't solidified himself as the GOAT in terms of the Olympics in tennis, would Fernando Gonzo be number two for the men? Like, bronze medal 2004, silver medal
08? If you go to Chile, like, I actually went to Chile in – what year did I go to Chile? 2010? There are, like – I'm pretty sure I still saw, like, Masu or Gonzalez or something on a billboard because those were, like – one of the very, very few gold medals. They got in doubles and then Messi won singles too, that Chile's ever won. Like, you're again set for life. And so certain countries that will mean tons and others it won't. Like, but like, again, just like, I just don't understand, like, the risk reward, like I'm saying, it's so good. Like, if you lose first round, no one's going to be like, oh, you flop. Like, you suck. Like, obviously there's no prize money, no ranking points, but the reward of getting out of there with being with an Olympic medal, I think it's worth so much to people. And I really do second guess the advice people are giving their players, agents, and coaches, steering them away from Olympics. I don't sort of trust that guidance. I got to say, I sort of side eye that pretty heavily.
So, and let's be honest, you're talking about the many young Americans who have opted out because that's the most notable example. I suppose Shapovalov would be the other young Canadian who opts out. Sinner would
well,
be a
I mean,
third one.
I mean, the Americans are an interesting example because, like, most of the Americans, I mean, they all would have been, like, long list medal threats, right? Like, you know, even if the A team, American A team, had shown up, you know, your Opelka, Fritz, Isner, and who was number four? Tommy?
Paul or Tiafo, yeah.
Okay, Paul
sure.
or Tiafo. Like, and Tommy, and they're both, and Paul and Tiafo both are going.
Yeah, Sandgren's but, around there as well.
Yeah, so, like, well, Sandgren's, like, 7 or 8, but, like, yeah. If even if those guys had gone, that would have been a surprise for them to win. Not impossible for one of those guys to semi, but it would have been a bit of a surprise. But, like, yeah, like, Sinner, Chapo, Raonic, obviously Nadal, but Nadal already has one. Like, I just feel like, you know, it'd be such a nice crowning moment for, like, if a Raonic had gone to Tokyo and had medaled, it would have been something that he could, it would be, like, something, honestly, you know, think of it this way, like, they're all going to die someday. Like, in your obituary, if you win an Olympic medal, that will be in the first paragraph. Of what you did as a tennis player.
That's why I think Hubi is, like, so well situated to make a run at this Olympics. He has the Masters title. He's made a semifinal. Like, this would be sort of that crowning achievement in the breakout season. Look, I think it fits the narrative. But to your point, I agree with you. It's like they're the Olympic Games. And, again, here in the United States, I feel like the effect of the Olympics is perhaps a bit nullified to some extent. But, like, around the world, everywhere else, I feel like the Olympics does mean more.
I know you love your next-gen boys, right?
Yes.
None of them have done anything in their careers to this point which would overshadow winning gold in Tokyo, right? If it's Tsitsipas, well, if it's
Zverev. You could argue Zverev's done one thing that might overshadow it.
Sure. Medvedev, you know, like, any of them. Chapo, you want to throw him in there, too. Obviously, he's out. But, like, if they win Olympic gold, one of those three, which they very plausibly could be one of those three if it's not Djokovic, that would be their crowning achievement to this point. That would be their calling card. And 100%. And they should be – and hopefully they're treating it as such. Like, it's still a big, big deal. It's still – it's way above a Masters event. And I know – I think Sam Querrey specifically has said, like, I'd rather win Indian Wells than win the Olympics. At some point, he did say that. But I don't think that most people feel that way. And – certainly not the winners. I don't think the winners, once you actually get there, I think it's an easy thing to sour grapes if you haven't won it, too.
He's also the exception because Indian Wells is like his home event. He is a California kid, so that would be the dream come true, perhaps, traveling there as a kid, whatever. But, no, I agree with you. The Olympics does mean something. Case in point, Novak Djokovic, who has the option to pursue history in a couple of routes here this season. He's already tied Federer Nadal with his 20th Grand Slam title. Yeah. He is only missing one thing from his mantle, of course. It is that, I mean, you could suppose the doubles and gold, and the gold medal in doubles as well, but he's missing that gold medal singles title. He made the semifinals back in 2012, ended up losing the match to, I want to say, Andy Murray
yep.
before getting knocked off in the bronze medal match as well. Again, 2016. The notable first round loss for him, to Juan Martín. I think 2008 he lost semifinals as well to Nadal.
You're right.
It wasn't semis, it was quarters. I know they played semis of that as well. So he's sniffed. He's been around there. He's never gotten over the winner's circle. Now, of course, there's two lines of thinking here. A, had he lost at any of the first three Grand Slams this season, there's not a doubt he would be playing these Olympic Games. And it is the one thing that he's missing. And at age 34, he's as close to his prime as he's ever going to be. And certainly the fact that a Medvedev, a Zverev, a Tsitsipas, a Berrettini haven't won their first majors, he's going to be as definitive of a favorite entering these Olympics as he will ever be moving forward. So, of course, this is the perfect combination of opportunity and you know, peaking Novak Djokovic entering these Olympic Games. And yet, he has the opportunity to do something that hasn't been done since the 60s, to be the first person since Rod Laver to win the calendar Grand Slam, all four slams in the same season. Of course, that would be his 21st Grand Slam singles title of his career, passing Federer, passing Nadal. It would be a fantastic redemption story given what happened at the 2020 U.S. Open as well. And there is a line of thinking that he's putting that in jeopardy by playing these Olympic Games. Where does noted Djokovic, I was going to make a dig at you, but then I'm thinking, I'm pretty sure a couple days ago you tweeted that you think Djokovic is the GOAT and it's not particularly close. So where does noted Novak Djokovic supporter Ben Rothenberg stand on this issue? Because that's the story of the men's
side. Djokovic, you know, like exalter and hagiographer at this point. Yeah, no, I said Djokovic was the was the GOAT before the Wimbledon final, before he even got to 20. It was when I said that, and yeah. I still totally stand by that. I mean, just from a if you're doing the statistical GOAT, right? Which I'm open to there being other conversations and other arguments towards GOAT that are not based on that first and foremost.
Who is the best tennis player? A player of tennis, excuse me.
That's a different conversation. So, but yeah, so yeah, I think Djokovic would have been crazy to pass this up because he's never won it before. Like you said, next time he's going to be 38. Who knows what he'll still be doing if he's still be playing at that point. And yeah, and it's going to be on clay also, which he's not going to love in 4 years at Roland Garros in the 2024 Olympics. So, or 3 years, actually, only 3 years away. But so actually he'll only be 37. Okay, recalibrating a bit. But
in that case,
the chance to go for a Golden Slam, which Steffi Graf won in 88, and is considered obviously a crowning achievement, still unique to her. And she was just destroying people in 88 all over the place. For him to have that chance, sure. And, like, I don't think there's any reason to think that he is imperiling his U.S. Open by going to the Olympics. Where it becomes peril is purely from an emotional exhaustion standpoint, right? Like, if you go, because you saw how much the Olympics meant to him in 2016, right? When he loses to Del Potro first round and weeping as he leaves the court. And you saw Del Potro trolling him on Instagram today. That was pretty funny. Where Del Potro posted a photo of himself on the plane to Tokyo, and Del Potro was like, well, you actually have a shot at this one because I'm not going, essentially, which was fantastic. Good to see Del Potro also hitting recently as well. But Djokovic should go. Like, he's plenty of time to recover, too. This is a July tournament, you know? Like, there's no reason why it should derail you for late August, unless there's some sort of emotional exhaustion. And that will be the thing that will be the key for him in New York, too, looking a little bit ahead to that, because I know that's kind of what you're going for, right? Like, his calendar slam shot here. That was what happened with Serena. It was just the pressure and the emotional weight of it all finally, like, wore her down. And you saw that so much in the loss to Vinci and how that match went. That's going to be the battle for Novak. Gonna be if he beats himself or if he sort of implodes or collapses in some way, more than anybody having the real tennis to beat him best on best. That's not going to happen right now. I mean, I really think his C game is better than everybody else's A game at this point. and he's just that much better than the field. You're making a face, but you know it's true.
B
you
minus.
You know it's
game.
True.
B
C
minus.
Plus. We'll settle on C plus.
No. It's got to be B minus because if it's C plus, I think some of the next gen guys are in C plus range. Like if it's C plus, you don't think Medvedev can. Whatever. We're not doing this debate right now. Yes.
No,
okay.
No.
Sure.
No. I think that I think Djokovic has been so good at managing himself recently.
Well, the point is he didn't play his best at Wimbledon and he still won it, dropping only one.
And that was
what,
A plus
so,
ever
like,
from Chapo that he beat in straights and 100%. Not his best.
No, Chapo played better than him. And he lost the match in straight.
So there you go. Yeah. Like, so anyway, so
you're right.
I think Novak is C plus. I think Novak is. I think Novak is really set to do big things. And and just like passing it up again. They're talking about regrets. Like, especially if you win the U.S. Open, people will be like, "You didn't get that gold medal, dude. Like, what were you thinking?" And he'll have more shots at 21. And like for me, again, I'm already on record saying I think he's the GOAT already statistically, even with only 20. Even if, let's say, Rafa wins 21 in New York, or Fed, for that matter. Like, if one of them pulls ahead, like, doesn't make Novak less dominant. I think the margins. I definitely feel this way for Serena and Margaret Court. If you even want to consider her record real, which I don't, but like. The difference between 23 and 24 or between 20 and 21 is so marginal. Like, you have 5% more slams than somebody. Like, I just don't think that's that big a deal. Like, I think the difference between someone who won one slam and won two slams, that's big. The difference between winning two slams and three slams, that's pretty big. The difference between winning 20 slams and 21 slams, like, in the end, you're not going to really pay attention to how many are in your cabinet unless there's some really OCD census happening all the time. So I just think that, I think he's doing the right thing by playing. I was relieved to see him play. I was annoyed when he said he was only 50-50 after winning Wimbledon. And I'm glad that he landed on the head side or whatever he called on his Serbian coin to get rolling to Tokyo.
No, I mean, you're absolutely right. And, you know, the difference, Steffi Graf, to go back to her crowning achievement again, 1988, she becomes the only player to win all four slams and the Olympic medal in the same year. She was 19 years old. Djokovic is 34. Mm-hmm. Like, the difference between some of these young players not playing, say a Shapovalov, say a Casper Ruud, who will represent Norway someday at the Olympics, is that they will have other opportunities. They do only have to wait 3 years to get there. Meanwhile, just making up for lost time, making up for repetitions. I'm not saying I agree with the argument as you now shake your head at me. I'm saying that I can understand the logic behind the argument of go play events,
Casper, I mean, Casper's an interesting one because like he's not a great hardcore player, so he's not like he's somebody who is well served ranking wise by going to play Bostad and whatever else is going to vulture over this next month to get himself close to the top 10, you know, really away from the spotlight. Because he's some, I don't know if you saw, we did a feature on NCR where could pick Casper Ruud out of a lineup. Did you see this? This was actually phenomenal content.
I have not. Could she do it?
I don't want to give away, but it was not automatic for her, put it that way. Actually, had to work at it.
Okay.
So,
I think I could.
I'm pretty sure you could do it. Yes, I mean I could do it too. But just saying, like, he's not made an impact. And she calls herself jokingly ATP outsider, right? But Casper's done very little on a big stage in the sport, honestly, right? But doing well at the Olympics and being a great, you know, being one of the better, already best tennis player in Norwegian history, right? Like going to, at least in modern times, you want to talk about like Mallory Bjørstad or whatever back in the 10s. Like, I don't know if she represented Norway.
Shout out Mallory Bjørstad.
Absolutely. Nothing but love for her on this podcast, as I hope people are aware.
At this point, podcast, as you know.
She did represent the U.S. for a while, but anyway, I don't want to go too deep into her. With Casper, like, you know, like, but why? Like, you know, like, because you don't know if you're going to, you know, honestly, not to be pessimistic, like, you're going to blow out your knee and just be, like, screwed and you won't get to play, you know, Paris in 2024, if that's what you're talking about. Like, you don't take having the chance and passing it up. It's just a move, especially when you've never done it before, when you're a first timer, talking to you, Ruud, Sinner, Korda, Opelka, Fritz, all those guys. Yeah, of course. Like, and shout out to them for listening, obviously. But you know, it's not something you're going to look back on and be like, that was something I feel great about. There will have been logic that will have convinced you at the time, and there will have been short term rewards for it. Like, one of you might win a Los Cabos title, and that'll be nice, I guess. But like, honestly, like, who cares compared to the Olympics? Like, it's the Olympics. It just seems fun. I've been to one Olympics in my life. I went to Sochi, and just like you get caught up in like the buzz of it, even if you're.
Probably really cool to be 23 and be in the Olympic Village, even with cardboard beds. Like I bet. That's
I hear those
really
are sturdier than you'd think.
Yeah, and guess what? They're athletes. They don't need the bed.
They're gonna be okay.
Yeah, exactly. And so the point being, I'm playing the devil's advocate just to offer the other side of the explanation. You kind of named it there. He's also got an inside shot at the top 10 if you're Casper.
Yeah.
And like all of these guys going to play the City Open and just preparing for these summer hardcore events where there's money in play, where there's points in play. To some of these young players, that is still of value. And I you're making a face to say you
understand.
No,
I completely
understand.
I'm saying Casper, let me pull up the schedule here. Casper, I'm not sure what his schedule is exactly, but he's
playing another clay court event.
He is, but I'm not sure if he's playing Umag or Gestad. But I was going to say, like, he's, without looking at the draws to actually confirm, like, he's going to get appearance money from Umag or Gestad, and then Kitzbühel if he wants to play that too, you know.
No, he was the number one seed last week. I think he's the number one seed this
week. Okay, so there you go. So, I mean, he's, you know, as a top 20-er, especially in a tough time, you're going to get good money. Those tournaments still want to happen. And as much as I sort of think that part of the calendar is not great for the big picture sport, especially on the women's side, like, on the women's side, they go basically from Wimbledon to just like a month of European clay. 250s. It's just like so suboptimal for
minus Prague. Shout out
to Prague for being on hard courts. Absolutely, actually. But yeah, just like look at that section of the calendar. I'm like, what is happening here? There's no value in any of this. And I know that like macro, like forest for the trees, or micro, like it's nice that Poland gets the tournament. It's nice that you know
Budapest
you know that these tournaments can exist for the local markets, but they don't help the big picture of the tour at all. Anyway, so. That's sort of a sidebar onto so Casper I get for him, but like still, and he is actually close to a tangible goal, and hopefully he's thinking as mechanically like I can get top 10. Like hopefully there's like a real sort of cynical ambition there that he's done the math or someone's done the math and be like you have a real shot at sort of sneaking into the top 10 if you peak at this moment where the castle's unguarded, you can do it, and maybe then Courtney will recognize you. But until then, like, but for a lot of players, generally, they don't have that, and there's no reason why someone else should be chipping in or stepping back.
There are a lot of players with cynical ambitions. I don't think Kasperud's one of them. I think he's a guy whose ambitions are very optimistic. I don't think there's.
Well,
cynical.
I mean, not cynical, but like calculated,
no,
right?
I know, calculated. I know. I know. I'm just giving you a hard time. I just think that's an interesting description. But the point being. And this is sort of the question we have coming into every event that Novak Djokovic is in. If it's not Djokovic, who's your guy to watch this Olympics? Medvedev, this surface, we've seen him win Shanghai. We've seen him have success in the Asian swing. It just feels like he's tailor-made for these Olympic Games. I feel like it's going to be a Russian. I could see it being Rublev. I could honestly see it being Khachanov as well. And just, you know, again, I'm not going to make you talk more about Zverev because God knows you do enough of that. But like, I feel like it's the same group as always.
Well, we'll see
right?
how it's playing. If it's playing really slow, then that would point more towards Zverev or Tsitsipas. I guess Tsitsipas can play on faster courts, although his grass results have been subpar after starting okay in his career at the grass. I don't know. I think Medvedev is a pretty good favorite, a good solid bet, and he's been playing decently enough. To where he'd make sense as a pick. You mentioned Hubie. You know, I think there's like a solid cast of characters to be credible medalists there. And if you even get somebody random, you know, if you get like who would count as random here? Like if you get look around the map here.
Sasha Bublik.
Or even like I'm thinking like Bublik. I don't know, is Cam Norrie playing? Like if Cam,
no, he's
okay,
out.
Okay. Well, Cam, I was gonna say Cam Norrie would be like a very cool, like credible, like
a Cam Norrie type.
Yeah, okay. Sure. Like Milman, right? If Milman's there, I know Milman's
Ugo
there.
Ugo Humbert.
I'm saying Milman. If Milman goes and he gets like a bronze medal, that's lovely. You know, that's like something he can hang his hat on. That's like his, like, it'll be his claim to fame for the rest of his career. He's been a US Open quarterfinalist. He's had some good results, like at times, but to actually have something to show for your career in terms of hardware, people will understand. That's again what the Olympics kind of is about for a tennis context. I think it's like tennis is included in this wonderful world spectacle where we give out these prizes that mean a lot to the whole world and translate and are valuable currency out in the world. have a shot at one, and you know, you win four matches, and you have or five matches, I guess, to win a medal in the Olympics. If you win five, you definitely get one of six for gold. Maybe doing my math wrong, but but it's so for someone like a Millman, for someone like a Tiafo, like a I'm trying to think of other sort of players in that range here, like Sonego or
a Kecmanovic.
Yeah, well, that's a little bit deeper cut, but like those guys, they could do something. It would be great for them. It would really transform their legacies in the sport, and I just wouldn't pass it up if I was a player. Hell no.
No, I think you've made that clear, if nothing else. But from a tennis perspective, it's all the guys you would expect, right? And it really is tough to say till we know the conditions, till we know exactly what the draw is going to look like. But, yeah, there are your usual group of contenders outside of Novak Djokovic. That being said, quick prediction, men's side. Djokovic winning that elusive gold medal?
Yeah. I mean, like, of course. Yeah. Like, I mean, a peak Medvedev can beat him, too. Peak Medvedev is somebody who, like, maybe does challenge a little bit of my solar AC game kind of thing, but he's kind of alone there, I feel like, right now. And just, like, because he's also good mentally when he wants to be. Although that Australian Open final was such a dud in the end. So maybe a little bit burnt on that. But, yeah, like, you just saw it with Tsitsipas in the French Open. Like, Djokovic is so good at giving the guy a lot of rope, but still, you know, being in control of the match, even if it looks like it's slipping away from him. So...
Mm-hmm. No, that's Zverev match in Australia as well. He's down breaks and sets 3 and 4. He ends up winning it in 4 sets. Yeah, I think it's Djokovic's to lose. I do still think ton of fun storylines. And again, silver medal, bronze medal. If Zverev could win a bronze medal match, maybe that does do something for his confidence. Just getting over that finish line with a prize on the line, or just any of these young players. Maybe you're the guy who beats Djokovic. I really do. Hubie for the bronze, if I could bet it, I would. Trivia, I just have this feeling.
Trivia for you, you probably do know this. You know who beat Federer in 04 Olympics to get his career kickstarted?
Federer at the 04 Olympics. It wasn't Andy Murray. It was Novak Djokovic, I'm going to say.
No. It's Burdich.
Burdich
came out of kind of nowhere.
I didn't know that. And I was going to say Joachim Johansson.
No, Burdich came out of kind of nowhere and beat Federer in the third round, I want to say, in Athens. And yeah. Federer was the guy, obviously, already at that point in 04. And he was able to parlay that into, like, being confidence boost that helped him believe he was a top player and got a master's title in Bercy either that year or the next year. And, yeah, developed into being a really solid top 10 guy. So, yeah, there is definitely – that's actually a good alternate prize, is being the person who stopped Djokovic from either winning the Olympics or winning the U.S. Open. Like, that's a meaningful achievement, too. Everybody remembers Roberto Vinci. Who remembers Roberto Vinci more than Panetta at that slam, honestly? 100%. So, yeah, that's an interesting sort of thing to think about as terms of other prizes. You mentioned one thing about Zverev, about him, how this would be a confidence boost for him if he wins bronze. I don't think Zverev is short on confidence at all. I don't think that's ever been the issue. He believes.
Just getting over a finish line like that?
He believes. It's not that. Like, there's no shortage of self-belief with Zverev. That's not the issue.
I like to hear that, I suppose. But, no, I mean, again, all of these players, a run from a young Felix, that's something to get after. I think the doubles pairings are certainly going to be enjoying as well. But
that's another thing. Gears. You can win them double. You can win a medal in doubles, and people are still like, whoa, you won an Olympic medal. That's awesome. Like, again, and that's, you know, Federer's Olympic gold medalist from doubles. And
I'm saying
that's
it right now,
Bublik,
Rybakina, mixed doubles champions.
That'd be cool.
Here first.
That'd be cool. If they get in. I hope they get in. Right? That draw is tough to get into, even with this depleted field. Olympic mixed, tiny 16 draw. That's very annoying. It should be a bigger draw. That's my main Olympic complaint, is Olympics should be the easiest fix to make it a 32 draw for mixed as well. It shouldn't be a devalued competition. Still the same medal, just as heavy. I would also love to reform it into being some sort of more team event. That'd be kind of cooler than just the standard single elimination tournament. It's pretty unimaginative.
Yeah, no, again, things to work on as well. But switch gears, we go to the women's side. It's as wide open as any women's event is. Now, certainly Ashley Barty enters with the momentum, but you've got an Aryna Sabalenka lingering in the draw. You've got... I mean, do you want me to list all of the players? All of them. They're all there, minus the ones we named earlier. So I suppose there's no Bianca Andreescu. There's no Simona Halep. There's no Sonia Kenin. But it is Naomi Osaka, home event, on a hard court. She's won the last two majors on a hard court, separated herself from the field in doing so, was so, so excellent in both that 2020 U.S. Open run and the 2021 Australian Open run. We haven't seen her in a while, but is she still your favorite entering the event? What are your thoughts?
Oh, I don't know. I don't think that's fair to her to make her a favorite after having the kind of hiatus she's had, which could not have been easy for her, obviously, ducking out of the French Open, or leaving the French Open, that's maybe a better word, the way she did. Still obviously not in a great mental space there, and her training, obviously, I'm sure it's been affected by that a bit, and hasn't played a competitive match in a long time, while these other players are coming off two full slams of match toughness, and it's going to be a ton of pressure on her, both with, obviously, all the pressure that was going to be there already with the Tokyo Olympics and being the face of those sorts of games, and also all the additional, you know, microscopes she's under from the statement she's made and her media profile and getting, you know, ridiculous commentators on her life now. Your Megyn Kellys, your Piers Morgans, who are just weighing in on her every move now. That's not going to be easy. And so I think if she does do anything, gets a medal, that'd be an unbelievable achievement. Even if this is a good surface for her and a good conditions for her, and she has played well in Japan in her career. But, I don't know. I don't know what to think. I mean, I think Barty's still a fair favorite. You know, Barty's a good hardcore player. Is the informed player, won Wimbledon fairly comfortably. You know, a Pliskova is playing well, too. Has also won Tokyo in the past. It's sort of a classic women's tournament. I think Osaka's definitely the wild card in the sort of sense of being the unpredictable quantity here. But it's still women's tennis. It could be fairly chalky. I mean, Wimbledon was fairly chalky by women's tennis standards. Or it could be, here's your gold medal, Tamara Zidancic or Pavlyuchenkova. Honestly, like, those are things that could happen and wouldn't be shocking.
No, here's why it's on my radar. Sabalenka-Murray parallel, 2012 to now, too easy to make. Like, she comes off of a semifinal at Wimbledon, big run for her. Now, it's not a direct comparison, but she gets a breakthrough run here, wins a gold medal at this Olympic Games, carries that into success at the U.S. Open. I think she's very much primed to do so. I think you look at someone like Iga Swiatek. Why can't she win these Olympic Games, get herself a little bit of momentum heading
she's
into
a good
summer
pick.
Hardcore stretch? Yeah, of course. In all of them, Krejcikova's been so excellent. Maria Sakkari's made very, very clear how important these Olympic Games are for her. I'm not saying she's the favorite to win the gold, but if we see her in the mix for the bronze medal, I don't think that should surprise anyone. To your point, it's an open field like any WTA event is, but when we talk about the using the Olympics as a catapult into making a jump, this year's women's singles field feels particularly well suited to serve as a mechanism for that.
No, I mean, like, I think it's a great chance at women's tennis for more data. You know, like, we're just still trying to figure out what's up in women's tennis, like, who's, like, really got the goods, who's really the best, what the story really is. Barty obviously gives some clarity. She's clear number one at this point. That's something you can sort of solidify around. But, you know, Olympic medal is going to mean something to somebody, presumably, and it's going to be another sort of, you know, mark of something, of proof of greatness for one of these women who wins it, or three of these women who win them, you know, get on the medal stand. So, whether it's a Krejcikova, absolutely killing ladies in Prague. You see these score lines she was doing in Prague? I mean, that's she has not missed a beat from winning Strasbourg French Open, tough 2-set loss to Barty in the fourth round of Wimbledon, and then coming to Prague on the hard courts there and really taking care of business. I mean, 2-0 in the final, 1-2 in the semi, 3-0 in the quarter against her doubles partner Siniakova. Like, just savagery from Babs. And, you know, that's nice to see. Like, I would love to see her sort of parlay that into a really good Olympic performance. That'd be cool to see as well. You know, but it can be anything. There's also, like, I also don't like predicting fields before the draw, too. And the draw can depend a lot. So I'll save more meaningful, granular predictions of who can do well when the draw's out. But, but it's going to be an interesting field for sure. There's a lot of interesting contrasts and everything. Again, compared to the men's side when it's on the men's side, it's still Djokovic or the field. But I really do like that also that in the Olympics, you know, silver medal, bronze medal, real prizes. There are real consolation prizes in this tournament. And it'd be nice. It'd be, you know, like Chapo at Wimbledon, you know, probably would have won, I'm guessing, like a bronze medal match at Wimbledon against Hurkacz, if that had been such a thing existed. It'll be nice for someone to get that feeling at Tokyo.
Yeah, go watch the celebration between Jack Sock and Steve Johnson after they win that bronze medal in 2016. Go watch any of the looks on any of these players' faces. Petra Kvitova in 2016 when she bounces back to win the bronze, or just time after time after time. These Olympics do matter, and so that is why they're an exciting moment on the tennis schedule. Of course, again, as an Andy Murray fan, the Olympics will always be near and dear to my heart, but we sort of talked about the players, the characters. Any other storylines, any things you'll be watching for in specific? Obviously, really, really sad to note how many players have tested positive for COVID over this stretch of time. Now, some of them haven't even traveled to Japan yet, but of course, there is no rest in the tennis schedule. After the Olympics, you'll go right into Rogers Cup, Western and Southern, U.S. Open stretch. Testing positive for COVID matters. Like, we do wonder, how does this affect golf? How does this affect Demon Hour? There are two players who can play significant roles this summer. That's something I'm certainly watching for. Curious if there's anything else you'll be looking for.
No, I think the COVID thing is a down but good note to end on. It's an absolute wild card again, or, you know, question mark or random factor that could be at play in a lot of this year's tennis too. I mean, like Djokovic, you know, like one of the biggest threats to him completing his Golden Slam is going to be getting forced out for some sort of, you know, close contact type situation, or testing positive himself is a little less likely because he's already had the virus, but it's not possible that he could do it again with a variant. You know, that's going to be a real risk for him. That's one of the biggest risks for him completing this history, is that sort of situation. And yeah, we've seen it again with players like Konta, you know, losing her Wimbledon as the top Brit, you know, because of COVID, not getting to play Olympics because of COVID. And it just, like, it boggles my mind. These players who, so many of them, like a Konta, are so meticulous about their training regimens and so professional about so many things, but yet leave this massive thing to chance by staying unvaccinated. I think it's such a dumb move. And my level of sympathy for people who going forward are testing positive is going to be very, very low. Testing positive having not been vaccinated, which does greatly increase your chances of contracting the virus, not being vaccinated. Because there's plenty of chances. There was vaccination happening quietly at Wimbledon. There's vaccination happening in Washington coming up. I know there's a lot of events have been doing it. I know Belgrade got attention for it, but it's been more than just that. And Charleston also for the women. But it's been more than that that's been doing it. And yeah, like these players, just like the vaccine resistance among them, just from a purely talking about the cynical, like, where am I get the money? Like putting your Olympic or your U.S. Open prize money at risk by saying I'm vaccinated. Nutty. Yeah. That's my thought on that.
No, it's fair. Again, it's two pokes. Like, I promise, you'll be okay.
You'll be fine.
The radioactive glow, it looks really good when you have to go to the bathroom at night and you're like, do I need to turn on a light? Oh, I can sneak around because I'm glowing. That's great. Mm-hmm. And, like, you know how easy it is to avoid traffic when you have wings, Ben? Like, it makes life so much easier when you can just fly around and, like, yeah, that's the perks of the Moderna boy. Like, that's what I can do nowadays. So shout out to
exactly.
Moderna.
I have the Moderna, too. I had decently unpleasant side effects from the second dose in terms of having, like, fever or, like, chills and shivering a bunch, which was actually kind of cool because I was like, oh, wow, it's working. Like, I don't feel good. Like, I can feel it. And so that was all good. And the players all have time and opportunity to do it. And, yeah, sympathy very much waning to non-existent at this point for players, for athletes who don't do it and who also put other people at risk by continuing to be morons about it and just being bad members of society.
I agree. It's not hard to do. Again, they're scientists for a reason. Trust them.
It's also is nuts to me that, like, Indian Wells coming up is having rules you have to be vaccinated to be on site as a fan or a staffer or media or whatever,
but not
for the players. Yeah. Like, I mean, come on. Like, again, just like, this again just goes back to sort of bad COVID citizenship type rant that we were having a lot in 2020 about tennis players. It's continuing.
Amen. Again, well, with that in mind, that's exactly the note we wanted to end on. But hopefully we will get the chance to hang out a little bit this summer. I'm hoping to go to the City Open, hoping to get to hang out with the mayor of all things nightlife in D.C., Ben Rothenberg, figure out what's looking out down there. But, of course, catch some tennis as well. I will absolutely be at the Western and Southern Open, so I will see you there. And then, again, do I ever get a slam press credential to a Grand Slam? The world, it's like a center of the Tootsie Pop. How many licks? World may never know. It's an elusive number, but of course I know if I do not, I will be treated to exceptional coverage from my friend Ben Rothenberg. And there are many outlets in which your work appears. Where can we expect your work most recently coming up, or most soonest, I suppose?
Yeah, working on one story I've been working on for a while. Looking forward to that coming out eventually.
Is that a tease?
That's a tease, I guess, if you want to call it that. I mean, we'll maybe not the appropriate there. Term. But yeah, still working on that. And that's still not...
It may not be the appropriate term. Good point.
What's that?
It may not be the appropriate term.
No, probably
term
not.
For
story. But, you know, that's still something I have unfinished business on. I'm looking forward to finishing finally. And yeah, and otherwise, same old, same old. NCR, hopefully this week will happen. I've had a guest, trying to track down a guest to get the time done. We'd love to have you on again, Gruski. Certainly, if you're in Washington, we can do it. And yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing you again in person. We've met in person, like, briefly, for how much time we spent online together. You were in Cincinnati the one time in 2019 or 18?
19. Yeah, 2019. I definitely was like, hey, Ben, I'm Alex Gruskin. You're like, yeah, I know who you are now. And I was like, yeah, but you don't really know who I am yet.
I recognize your voice right away from those roundtables. I was like, oh my God, yeah. I know that voice.
Now
so
I'm gonna come up, sneak up behind you, like arm over the neck, like, you know, the grab and the hug and then, well, hug and, you know.
Is that I was waiting for you to segue into a Manscaped ad there, but yeah. No. Thank you for that experience.
Oh, that's funny. You know, you had me distracted. I'll throw it in post. All right. But no, that's very, very funny. Yeah, I'm excited to be back on scene. I'm excited to just be in front of these players. Like, press conferences for you at Wimbledon still Zoom, though, right?
Yeah, still Zoom. And yeah, I don't know what it's going to be in D.C. or Cincinnati or New York, honestly. They're still not totally nailing it down or not clarifying that. I feel like if, you know, U.S. Open, like, it's going to be no bubble, full attendance, like, no bubble for the players at all. Like, come on, like, let's have the press conferences be normal. Like, let's
just do it.
Let
the people in. Yeah,
I mean, you're right, because, like, it's kind of farcical to do it on Zoom from opposite sides of the wall when the players are there. And if you want to have us be masked in the room, we can do that. But, like... Yeah, I miss the human element of that part a lot. That was theoretically what the value on-site media provides is the being there. That's what people can't do. Like, you can all, especially in this day and age, every single court is streamed and available on demand often. Like, everyone can watch some matches now. That part has been democratized and spread out, excuse me, which didn't used to be the case back, you know, even when I first started. Mm-hmm. One of the first things I ever did to get Corey's attention was I live tweeted a match between Ivanovic Azarenka first round. Good match. And yeah, just like having, you know, that was back in the day. What sports writers did was, like, you guys couldn't watch this sporting event, so here's what it looked like and sounded like, and here's the, you know, the break, what happened on a break point or whatever. Like, it was that basic, you know. Mm-hmm. Back when I was even, you know, in high school, like, Miami, even, which is a big tournament, you know, one of the biggest tournaments in the U.S., like, wouldn't kick on TV coverage until, like, maybe the quarterfinals. Mm-hmm. You know, like, or at least maybe a weekend match or something, but, like, you didn't get to see stuff, and now you see everything. I think people take that for granted. So, no, it's pretty cool. Yeah, no. Ivanovic Azarenka.
In other words,
and also the same tournament, I believe, was Sharapova Kuznetsova. Also, was the first round match there.
And to be clear, we got to this rant by me asking, "Where can we find your work most recently?" And of course,
thank you.
Referring to, I guess you got to go back to the 2010 archives to find live.
Yeah,
tweets.
2010 daily forehand. I think it's available on the Wayback Machine, and yeah, it's still there. I'm sure I did some decent work. I think 2010, I think I did an interview with Akul Amamurodova there. Ooh. Pretty sure. Mm-hmm. And I am pretty sure I also, when the men's, because back then Cincinnati was women's week and then men's week. It was back-to-back weeks, which also used to be when Rome used to work, for those of you old enough to remember. And I did an interview with Timo de Bakker, I remember, on the men's side that week. Timo de Bakker. Mm-hmm. And not much became of him.
Shout out to Tiamo. No, the Brazilian. One of the... Danish? Where is he from? No, not Danish.
Two strikes.
Not from Netherlands?
There you go, Netherlands, third. There you go. You got it on your third try.
Did I say Danish? I didn't mean Danish.
You said Brazilian, and then you said Danish.
I meant from Netherlands the whole time. Brazilian was just an incorrect guess, but I meant the Netherlands, not Danish.
All right.
Anyways... Point being, leave all of that in. What do they call someone from Netherlands? I'm Dutch. I was like, that's
Dutch
what I meant. That
word.
Was the D I was looking for. I was like, not Danish, Dutch. Again, that's why you're the trivia champ. I am not. We have come full circle here. Leave all of that in. Oh, you have a final parting thought for us?
Well, I was just going to say, that's the D I was looking for. It's also great Manscaped ad lingo.
And you
that's
can see
where it,
it
was.
You can see it now with our friends at Manscaped, Manscaped.com. The promo code is NewBallsPlease. Shout out to the NewBallsPlease. Anyways, with all that said, Ben Roethlisberger, you can find him on Twitter. You can mistake him for Ben Roethlisberger. You can find his work, of course, on the New York Times crossword puzzle leaderboard and a trivia outlet near you. Ben, thank you, as always, for taking the time. Be safe. Be healthy. Take it easy, my friend.
Thanks, Alex.
Hope all of you enjoyed my conversation with Ben Roethlisberger. A huge thank you to him, as always, for taking the time to chat. I hope you listeners can tell he has been far too kind to this podcast, and so we always enjoy having him on the show. It's a very fun dynamic, and so he knows he's always invited back, and I'm sure if you're listening to this podcast, you've read his work, you listen to No Challenges Remaining, you read his pieces, New York Times, Racket Magazine, wherever they may be, and yes, he has some very interesting developments in the future, so be on the lookout for all of them, of course. If you've missed any of our other conversations, we've had a lot of good ones of late. Here on this show, we've been joined by David Kane, Jeff Sackman, Gary Nathan, David Gertler. Hopefully all of you have enjoyed those shows and feel adequately prepared for the oncoming onslaught of professional tennis events. Of course, if you've missed out on any of the content, you can find it all on the website, crackrackets.com. You need the more immediate updates, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube. We are at crackrackets. You want to message me directly, I'm at Great Shot Pod. A shout out, as always, to our super producers, Max Fleeter and Daniel Westoff, for the of an editing job they do day in, day out. A shout out as well to our friends over at Turn of Tennis. Remember, contact sales at uniquesports.com or call 800-554-3707. With all that said, for our fantastic guest, Ben Roethlisberger, our super producers, Fleeter and Westoff, our friends at Turn of Tennis, and from all of us here at both Cracked Rackets and the Tennis Channel Podcast Network, I'm your host, Alex Gruskin. You know what we say. Hey, great shot, and we will see you all tomorrow. Thanks, everyone.